Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Caraval. John was born in Minneapolis in 1951. His family moved to Norway, where he was raised, educated, and married. He worked as a journalist in Oslo for 10 years and joined a Scandinavian business publication in New York in 1983. In 87, he got pulled in the world of data, mining large databases for trends. He's worked for TRW, CDB, Infotech, Axiom, and others. His relationship with San Diego-based DataQuick Information Systems goes back to 1989, and the statistics he generates are used by public agencies, lending institutions, title companies, etc. And John, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I guess I've benefited from DataQuick's information as much as anybody, because I pay attention to an awful lot of it. So thank you.
You're welcome.
What is it that DataQuick provides for their customer base, and who is their customer base?
Well, one step back. DataQuick is a public records database repository based in San Diego. So anything that's a matter of public record when it comes to real estate is in the database. And it's a nationwide database. It's got all the sales information that's a matter of public record, names, dates, you know, loan amounts, price, sales count amounts, refis, all sorts of stuff there. So it's just a huge computer in San Diego that has all this stuff in it. And DataQuick has, over the past 30 years, sold access to that database. And that access is, you know, sold to banks, title companies, real estate agents, appraisers. It's sold in a variety of ways. You know, it used to be on microfiche. Mm-hmm. There have been, you know, online access. Now there are big data dumps there. So that's DataQuick's core business, is providing access to all that transactional information there. Additionally, you know, over the years there, they've generated products that are focused on specific participants in the real estate market. They've got products for banks, you know, that'll show banks what their market share is in an area or within a loan category. It's got products for title companies, appraisers, real estate agents. But by and large, DataQuick's main focus is on making sure the data is as current as it can be, as accurate as it can be, and that their coverage is good. So that's kind of DataQuick's backdrop. Now, my mandate with that stuff, the main part of the business is much bigger than just me. I just sit up there in the mountains here and Running Springs, and they've given me a wide open hose to the data there. And I open the spigot every night, and I download stuff, and then I generate statistics. And these statistics are the ones that make their way into the newspapers. And then we also sell those statistics to banks, title companies, builders are a big customer of ours.
Now, you've been doing that for them since about 1989. How long have they been collecting that as well?
Oh, DataQuick started this in 79.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to remember that, you know, this is going way back, but back in the 70s and 80s there, it really wasn't cost efficient to maintain a database like that. It was really just too expensive to maintain the computer power you needed back then to archive this stuff. Now, I've got every single home sale in the country on my hard drive and on some backups up in Running Springs. But if you go back 30 years, that was incredibly expensive. You know, we were talking data upgrades. I remember when I started doing this with DataQuick, they were saying, oh, well, we've got to let all of this data go so we have room for this other stuff coming in. Mm-hmm. It was a huge issue, because they'd let good stuff just scroll off and go down the drain. And it was just incredibly bothersome to me, because I like a good history.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I was just going to say, you and I are pretty sensitive to letting go history, because that's really what you end up being able to most accurately predict what's going to happen, is take a look at enough backwards.
Oh, I remember when they had to let 7 years worth of NOD data go. It was just heartbreaking for me. But they needed to ramp up and use that space for something else, and it was a good stretch of NOD data, notice of default data. That's the first step of the foreclosure process.
Right.
And it had all that information in there, and it was about 7 years worth of NOD data. And they just, you know, it just wasn't cost efficient to keep it. Back, yeah, we have to remember that, you know, NODs and foreclosures were just literally completely uninteresting back in, say, the late 90s and on into 2000 there. You know, there was just nobody that was interested at all in anything that had to do with foreclosure activity. Everybody, you know, we had a steady state of price increases, and there was nothing out there that they could use that archive data for, so it scrolled off. Well, now, that doesn't happen anymore, but it did then.
I wonder if just real estate in general, actually, that how it was used prior to 1970, to me, had to be very different than after that, because prices didn't accelerate until mid-70s after. I mean, when you triple in price in California in about a five-year period, you generate a lot of interest as an investment. Prior to 70, it was really an occupancy inventory rather than an investment vehicle.
And, you know, the information just didn't exist. You know, you've gone out there and researched this stuff, and you've told me about that. I know of others that have tried to go out there and pull this stuff up. There are UCLA, going back about 15 years there, they assigned 3-4 students to go out there and read the classified ads of newspapers going back to the 1920s there. And boy, what a job that is, number one. And, the students just got tired of doing it there. I think the whole thing died on the vine.
I went back with to Washington, D.C. with Sean O'Toole. I know you know him from Foreclosure Radar.
Yeah.
And we went to the archives there and looked at interest rates from 1850 on, just because we were curious. So if you want to sit there and do it long enough, you can make some headway.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to remember, though, too, that the interest rate stuff probably was kind of back of the book stuff until the 30s.
Okay.
I think the 30s, it became common to finance the way we recognize home financing now. It was different, but it was still a lot the same. Prior to that, it was like some foreign countries there where you basically just had to, you know, you didn't have access to a mortgage.
It was short. It was half of the purchase price,
yeah.
And it ended pretty quick.
Yeah, exactly.
So you better pay off fairly fast.
Yeah.
Now you also analyze what you see. So you joined the party in '89, which was really a peak of a market. And at what point did you start realizing, okay, this has reached a peak and is going to head the other way? And do you ever write that down where you say, okay, this is going to go down for a while? Is that ever part of what you do?
Well, this is where it gets kind of fussy and interesting at the same time, because, you and I, too, get asked to predict, to analyze, to pontificate.
Mm-hmm.
DataQuick and me, I really like, number one, I really like to be right. and I am a lot, but I've been wrong here and there. Thing is, though, that I'm, you know, my strength is knowing in great detail what's going on and what went on last year. And my only real attempts at, forecasting would be to say that if current trends stay in place, then this is what it's going to look like a half year, a year down the line. I'm pretty good at that. But I don't do a forecast. I do watch the forecasts because, you know, most of them out there use us one way or another, use DataQuick data. And so I do watch what what they do with our data out there. It's a hoot sometimes. It's a real hoot.
Well, it's also very different. I mean, sometimes I'll open my mouth and say for a long stretch this is going to happen, and I'm always being disagreed with by people that are a lot smarter than I am.
I don't know if you've got smarts out there that they don't have. They may have a PhD behind their name, but there's smarts you get when you're out there putting your own money at risk and doing what you've done there.
I think what you just said is really, when I look at a chart, I either feel pain or happiness.
But, you know, when it comes to analysis, there sometimes it's a slam dunk. Sometimes you just look at a graph and you know what's going to be going on the next 3, 6, 12 months. But sometimes you don't, and that's when it gets interesting. When it's a slam dunk, it's not really all that interesting. Like in today's market, there are certain things that are just self-evident that are going on. You know, as well as I do here, that prices right now are going up, and they will mm-hmm. in the foreseeable future, barring some meteor hitting, Chicago or something. Prices are just going to, incrementally go up, and maybe those increments are going to be bigger at some points in time, and some are going to be less, smaller at some points in time, but they're just going to go up. That's just in the cards right now. It's beyond right now that gets interesting, in a year or two or something like that. What happens when interest rates, edge up to 6 or 7? What happens when the Fed decides to take the punch bowl away? What happens when those things occur? And that's where you need to go out there and do an analysis. Along those lines, as I said, you've got some street smarts that a lot of us really envy you. But the fact of the matter is that now in the internet / blogosphere / whatever it is we're a part of here right now, everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's got an opinion, and they're all out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're all out there. I mean, just read one of those, comment sections after a newspaper article and say, the San Diego Union Tribune. It's a hoot. Everybody's got an opinion out there. And I think that now is the time for people to be very, very cautious about the judgment calls they make. It's harder to make a good call now than it would have been, say, 10, 20 years ago, because 10, 20 years ago, for better or for worse, the news content out there was vetted by editors in newspapers, and it was vetted by people looking it over there. And that's not happening now. Right now, everything's out there. So you've got to really develop your own sense of judgment out there when you evaluate the information flow.
Who really knows what they're saying, and who is just, trying to invent it on the run?
In addition to which, that the media crisis really has had a big effect on this. The big newspapers here in California, I can think back 15, 20 years ago, and I think of the people covering real estate in the business sections of the newspapers there, and there were, maybe 4 or 5 real, stars out there, and there were maybe 15 or 20 who were really good, and then the other ones would just rewrite press releases.
Right.
And that's not the case anymore now. There's like 1 or 2 really good ones out there, and maybe 3 or 4 semi-good ones out there, and the rest rewrite. And they know it. They rewrite press releases, but they also have much more to do. They have that 24-hour news cycle. They got a blog they got to maintain. They got to shoot stuff out on, Twitter. They got to do all sorts of other stuff.
Well, and you've been doing interviews a lot longer than I have, and I've been surprised when I've been interviewed by somebody from what I would have considered a major source and very credible, and then I find out, okay, you don't own a house and never have, or something like that, where they're going to write an article on trends, yet they haven't experienced one themselves at all.
Oh, there are so many of these people that are so wet behind the ears right now, Bruce. It's just, it's mind-boggling out there. I hope it's changing. I really do, because as you'd mentioned in the intro there, my background's in the press, and it just makes my heart break sometimes when I pull up. And at the other end of this is something else there too, and it's not just you and I, but others out there don't go out with what we used to go out with. If I go back 15 years, there was a topic list that I had that I kept, I maintained databases on, and I maintained a history of, and I would go out to the reporters and our editors monthly, and I'd say, hey, listen, this thing here in 3 months from now, this thing here looks like it's going to hit a bottom, or it's going to hit a turn. It's going to be something interesting going on. And I can't do that anymore. They're not able to handle the information the way they did, say, 15 or 20 years ago. They just aren't. So we sit there. Right now, my topic list of press releases is just 1/4 of what it was 10, 15 years ago, and it's just the easy top of the line stuff. It's sales counts,
okay,
it's medians, a little bit. We throw a little bit into the press release on cash sales and some foreclosure stuff and things like that. But it's nowhere near the depth of information that we would have provided the papers 10, 15 years ago.
One of the things you mentioned was the punch bowl. Well, when you're in the analyst business, the one thing you can't control is the giving of the punch bowl. Has anything that's been done in the last 6 years surprised you? I mean, you saw like the downturn between 90 and 96, and now we have this, and they've been a lot more aggressive in this downturn.
Yes. I missed the steep drop. I knew there was a correction coming. Everybody knew there was a correction, but that happens all the time. I had no clue that it was going to be as severe as it was, you know, from 2006, 2007 on. When it comes to the market there, the market has clearly overreacted. If you take a look at lenders, if you take a look at everybody out there, the pendulum clearly swung way, way, way back to the other side there, and created not only a market that was dropping, but we have to distinguish between a market which was in decline and also a market which became severely dysfunctional. So those two things have been playing into each other for years. They're starting to come back online right now. We're looking, for example, at numbers today and comparing them to numbers a year ago. And the year ago numbers were so lopsided. They were so dysfunctional, so lopsided that any trends we read out of today's numbers, comparing them to the stuff a year ago or even 3 years ago, we're already hearing, even though the market is just barely finding its footing there, people are already calling saying, oh, there's a bubble.
Bubble,
out there.
Yeah.
It just astonishes me.
Well, and that's a feeling again, instead of a statistic. And that's what's nice about statistics is if you have enough of them, you can go backwards and go, okay, well, no, this is not a bubble. Come on.
Well, if just take a look at the baseline stuff. You know, we have not had in California anywhere an average sales month since the fall of 2006. Every single month has been below average for that calendar month since 2006.
Okay.
And yet we have people talking about, you know, this explosion of sales, which is just ridiculous. We're not even to the midpoint. We're not even to the average there. If we take a look at prices right now, no matter how you do the numbers out there, we're just maybe one-fourth, one-third off bottom, you know, depending upon how you define the bottom and how you define the peak and, you know, where the mid-market there would be. And then if we start looking at the underlying stuff that is really quite important that you've looked at, taking a look at affordability and how much people actually pay as a percentage of their paycheck, you know, their household income there, those numbers are as low as we've ever seen them.
Right, still.
Still.
Yeah, that's what's interesting. If you take that number and you realize the interest rate difference between what you're saying, we're 25 or 30% off the peak, but our interest rates went down during that price rise. So that monthly payment that emerges is still the all-time sale.
Yeah. No, if you go out there and look at the median priced home in Southern California and you assume, you know, the regular, you know, down the middle, 20% down and a 30-year fixed mortgage there, a year ago, that payment was literally less than $1,000 per month. Mm-hmm. That was what your monthly mortgage payment would be. And now it's all the way up to about $1,100. It's astonishing.
when you talk about overreaction, part of the overreaction is on the sales side, people who lost their home and everything, but now you have overreaction on legislation side. So you have a Dodd-Frank bill that was created. And how restrictive do you think that's going to be in curtailing what would happen normally?
I don't know that Dodd-Frank is going to be as big an influence as some of the other policies that are made out there. I think right now that what we really have to watch out for are these overly cautious lenders. And I think the only way that that's really going to be rectified is with new lending institutions coming in there. There are just too many of the lending institutions that have survived the past 10 years that just are managed by overly restrictive risk management people, the bean counters that had to do the mop-up. And, you know, bless their souls for having mopped up after 2006, 2007. They did what they had to. But now is the time for a little bit more innovation and a little bit more thinking out there. You know, Dodd-Frank won't address the fact that a very wealthy person might want a second home out in the Coachella Valley and want to finance it. Somebody who might easily qualify for that, just won't, because those loans for a second home don't exist. You know, they used to be an ARM, you know, maybe with a higher down payment and a higher interest rate, and it was an ARM. It used to be available, but it's not out there anymore. And you've got a ton of pent-up demand out there. You've got an awful lot of empty nesters and retirees who would like to sell the family home to somebody and then move on. They can't do it right now, either because there's not enough equity in the property they want to sell, or because they just wouldn't qualify for a mortgage in today's mortgage environment there. So I'm not sure Dodd-Frank itself is the problem. I think it it's certainly out there as an issue, but it's I think the problem is that the lenders are just way, way too cautious right now.
And their overlays is kind of what you're talking about, are much more restrictive than the policies that are in place. When they put their overlay on it, it becomes almost impossible to say yes.
Oh, it's really hard. But you know, remember that all these loans, I mean, they were really quite good. All the loans are now, you know, the poster children for the subprime stuff. They're just not available out there right now. You know, low down payment loans, unless it's an FHA loan there, you got negative AM, interest only, ARM, stated income, you know, assumable. We had multiple loans. All of this stuff was really quite useful back when it came online. You know, you remember when was this? About late 90s there. You remember the 125s that DITEC went out with? Can you imagine them coming online right now? But precisely now would be the time where something like that would work.
It would work.
Wouldn't work within the framework. You know, it would have to be a lending institution working outside of the framework of what the current lenders, you know, the Wells Fargos and the B of A's of the world are working within.
I just started looking at reports because I'm going to start studying to write another one myself. And one of the reports I just scanned was FHA. And then in the comments section, it said that when we look back, 2010, 11, and 12 will be the safest years that we ever, the safest body of work, basically, we ever created.
And it's, you know, that's where the pendulum swung. You know, we go back and we look at so-called vintage when it comes to foreclosures. You know, when were these bad loans made? Who made the bad loans? And right now we're looking still. We've had the third quarter of 2006 is the vintage. Even today, after 4 years, those loans made during that period there are the ones that are the worst and still being foreclosed on at the highest rate.
Well, what's interesting about that too, though, FHA was really not much of a participant during that year, but they got the downturn because of it. So then when they participated in 07, 08, and 09, they were trying to catch a falling knife.
Which was just, you know, it's these canned narratives that come from, I'm not sure where they come from. You know, I've been hearing people saying, oh, well, all of this happened because the government decided that everybody was going to get a loan and all this kind of stuff, which was absolutely not true. I remember going to an MBA conference up in San Francisco at the Moscone Center, and one whole day of that conference was basically a bunch of panel discussions on how do we get the government, Fannie, Freddie, and FHA, how do we get them on board into this new world of mortgage finance that is out there? You know, why can't we get them to loosen up the way we have and participate in today's mortgage environment? That was the topic then.
Well, the author of Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank, one of them, I mean, he's on recording basically trying to do just that, trying to make sure that Fannie and Freddie get more aggressive.
Yeah.
And now, of course, that was a terrible mistake that he conveniently forgotten he participated in.
Well, they were late to the party when it came to that. They did participate maybe for the last 3 months or so. They had decided to kind of crank it up a little bit, but yeah. They didn't.
The FICO scores, that's one big difference, is that I know FHA, during those years, half of their loans were probably to FICO scores under 620. Mm-hmm. And in 2011, it was 3%. So they've definitely reined it in. Oddly enough, they reined it in when the monthly payment is less than rent.
Looking at all of those loans there, it's interesting to look at all of you know, we have all the loans that have gone bad, but what about all the loans that that haven't, where people have stuck it out? And there are an awful lot of people. They were first-time buyers. They were often minorities. They certainly barely got in by the skin of their teeth, and they have been hanging on by their fingernails since then.
And if they've hung on this long, what are the odds of them not making the payment? I mean, that's, I think all of the worst is behind us. John Carvall, thanks so much for joining us. We're done with our first segment, and we'll pick it up in a few.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.